This is an amazing text, and one that rarely gets read in places like this. It's a hidden gem in our Bible. But to really get at just how important it is that this text exists, was written down and then protected and handed down generation after generation, protected from those who undoubtedly would have wanted to get rid of it for the implications of what it's saying. Before we get into that text, we need to step behind it a little bit to set the context. So we have to go back to that starting gun, really, of our faith tradition, the big bang of our understanding of who we are as people of God, back to the Exodus. And remember that in that world, for the slaves that lived in that world, everything in that world reinforced the idea that the universe was on the side of Pharaoh, that all the gods were aligned on the side of Pharaoh. Pharaoh represented the government and the politics and the economics and the social life, and the gods were on the side of those who ruled that empire. And so everything was the way it was supposed to be. And the people who were slaves because that was where they were supposed to be. And then remarkably, these slaves had this insight that, no, all of that was wrong, all of these other gods were wrong, that there was one true creator God in the universe, and that God chose to stand with the slaves and not with Pharaoh. And when you believe that, then everything in your world, everything in that world of the Egyptian Empire gets turned on its head, and nothing is true. And so when these slaves escaped from Egypt and found their way up into Canaan and started to create a new world for themselves, a new nation for themselves, along with other people that had fled from other city-states in Canaan, when they went up into the hills and they started creating their own reality, they had to come up with a reality, a way of organizing themselves that stood in opposition to everything else that they knew in the world around them, because all the other little nations there in Canaan were little reproductions of the Egyptian Empire. They were all utilizing the basic same ideas of domination. And if you want to build a world that's the antithesis of that, you have to be pretty creative. Now, they didn't have a lot of examples of alternative governments to fall from. Most of the governments were kingdoms. And so with that one model of how to rule yourself, the Hebrew people came up with this ingenious notion of saying, there can be no way that we can entrust the role of king to any particular person or any particular group of people. Once that sort of power hits human hands, then it leads in a certain direction, and that is back towards creating the Egyptian Empire model, the model of domination. And so they came up with this ingenious idea of making God their ruler. God was their king. Ultimate authority rested in God. And God, they believed, was always on the side of those who were marginalized. So never, ever could the government turn its back on those who were poor and oppressed. They had a mechanism in the Bible. We find it in the book of Judges. They had this mechanism so that if there was a crisis, they would be able to have somebody who would come in and help make decisions quickly and rapidly. They had a mechanism for authority in times of emergency, and they called these people judges. But judges had no permanent role as rulers. They were there to handle emergencies, and then their power left when the emergency left. But beyond that, they also, not only did they give God the power of government, they also gave God the power of economics. They said this other very radical thing, and we can find that in the Bible as well, where God says to the people, you can't sell the land in perpetuity because it's not yours to sell. It belongs to me. It belongs to God. God ultimately owned the land. And land in an agrarian society was the means of production. It was the capital investment. It was the way you measured wealth. And land ultimately belonged to God. Human beings could lease the land from God, in a sense. They could use the land, but it was never theirs to own and do with whatever they wanted to do with it. It belonged to God. And then when we have that notion connected to those other notions about the Sabbath year, every 7 years there, the land would be given a break, and people would be given a break, and debts would be forgiven, and slaves that were slaves because of their debts would be freed. That was a reflection of the fact that God was running the economy and not people. And then after 7 Sabbath years, after 49 years, the year of Jubilee, when the land was redistributed, was another way of signaling that land wasn't something that people could control forever. It was just something that they could use for a period of time, and then God's will would intercede and redistribute the wealth of the nation. Now, there's absolutely no proof that the Sabbath year or the year of Jubilee was ever enacted, and there's absolutely no proof that it wasn't enacted either. We don't know. But it makes sense to have all of these ideas connected. The idea that God ultimately owns the land, and therefore, God, who's always on the side of the marginalized, would create rules so to allow the redistribution of wealth in the nation. So if you have that idea, then what you end up with is a nation that archaeology tells us it looks a little bit like the life of the people that lived up in those hills, and the people who started this new nation. You know, for us, it would seem a little bit like a hippie commune up in the hills. And they were creating their own world. And if you go, and archaeology says, you know, there were no monumental buildings. There were just simple houses. And people lived simple lives. And there was no great concentration of wealth, and there was no great concentration of poverty. People worked hard to eke out a living on the stony ground of those hills, but they did eke out a living. But after a few generations, the zeal of creating this alternative to the world around them probably faded. People who were born into the world that had been created there in the hills might not have seen it as such an exciting alternative. They would have seen their lives as being slated to be like their parents and their grandparents, the hard work on the farm year in, year out. But down in the valleys, down in the flatlands where the city-states were, there was this temptation. It's sort of like that old song after World War I. The soldiers came back from World War I, and the song went, how are you going to keep them down on the farm after they've seen Perry? It's sort of like that. The people who lived up in the hills, when they saw or heard about life in the cities down in the plains, cities that had kings and the whole systems of domination, you go in and you see, and there's these giant walls that protect the city, and there's this monumental architecture, giant temples and palaces and buildings for the wealthy, and you would see people wearing really fancy clothes, and you would see all sorts of fancy foods in the marketplace, all this stuff that was not a part of your world at all. You would see it down in the cities, all this shiny, glitzy stuff, and they wanted that stuff. That's the way we are as human beings. We see all the glitz and the glamour, and what we don't see is underneath that, all the suffering that comes to support that level of concentrated wealth. They only saw the wealth, and they wanted that. And so, after a while, they decided that they would get themselves a king. And so they came to Samuel, who was the last judge, not in terms of a legal judge, but in the terms of this populist leader. came to Samuel and said, "We want a king." And Samuel says, "Well, if you get a king, this is what's going to happen." And notice Samuel doesn't say, "If you get a king and it turns out to be a bad king, this is what's going to happen." Samuel says, "If you go this path of bringing in a king," and it's not just a king now, we're talking about bringing in a whole system of rule and governance, much like the rest of the world was set up. "If you bring that system in," Samuel says, "this is what's going to happen. Your sons are going to be drafted into the military and you're going to go fight the king's wars. Your daughters are going to end up being servants to the wealthy and the elite. You're going to lose the best of your land. In fact, over time, you're going to lose all of your land. In fact, over time, you're going to end up back as a slave." That's what's going to happen if you create the system. And it doesn't matter whether it's a good king or a bad king at the helm. That's the direction that it's going. In a sense, you can think of it as the nation as a train. And if you take that train and you put it on a particular set of tracks, that track of getting yourself a king, then the track leads in one direction. And that direction is to disaster. It's sort of like those charts that show differences over time. And if you can plot an event and then another event and another event over time, and then you can draw the average line and it shows a direction. It would have been like that. It is like that when we read the Book of Kings and the Book of Chronicles in the Bible. We have good kings and bad kings, good kings and bad kings. But what happens over time is this direction that leads the nation into worse and worse times. What Samuel says turns out ultimately to be true. The nation ultimately is destroyed, and the people are turned back into slaves. Again, this is not a belief in what happens when a bad person is at the helm. It's about handing power over to human beings. That sort of power must always be controlled. And the difference between politics and economics is really not that much of a difference. People can use political power to gain wealth. People can use wealth to control political people. They're two sides of the same coin. And both have to be monitored, or else injustice will flourish and people will suffer. And so, that brings us to today, where we sit in sort of a microcosm of the direction that the world is going here in Seattle, where we have this high concentration of millionaires and billionaires and this high concentration of homeless people. The system is doing what it's supposed to do, in that it's taking resources and putting them in the hands of fewer and fewer people. Now, over time, in this democracy republic that we have, our leaders have tried to figure out ways of diverting that power, limiting that power, and creating checks and balances in the government. And after the experience of the Great Depression, all sorts of government systems were put into place to protect people from the power of concentrated wealth. Back as late as 1944, the tax rate on the richest people in this country was over 90%, the income tax rate, 90%. Back in 1965, within my own lifetime, that tax rate for the wealthiest among us was 77%. Couple that high income tax with a high inheritance tax, and you were able to limit the growth of wealth. And then, as it got handed off to the next generation, to limit it again, so that you wouldn't be handing off great power from generation to generation to accumulate over time. It wasn't a bad idea. It actually helped spur America into great levels of growth. Middle class grew. People moved out of poverty. great new programs like Social Security and Medicare came into being. But over time, the wealthy have used their wealth to strip back those protections, and now they have the ability to concentrate great wealth in the hands of individuals and in corporations, and the direction is the direction that we see. Greater and greater levels of suffering and despair and suicide and violence. It's all part of the same train tracks, and Samuel's warning is a warning to us. It's not a question, then, about when we're talking about a head tax in Seattle or increased income tax elsewhere. It's not just a question of, will this money be used in the very best possible way? It's a question of whether or not those who have the most resources should be asked to contribute those resources to those who have the most need. That's a basic moral question. And one which our faith tradition has an answer. In those times when there was no king in Israel, they could call themselves people of the realm of God, of the kingdom of God, because God was ultimately their ruler. And Jesus sought to bring that notion back of a world in which God was the ruler, where God's will for compassion and justice guided human activity. That was the realm of God. And Jesus was very clear that if you had and held on to wealth at a time when there were people in need, that you didn't get it. You didn't understand what the realm of God was, and you were never going to get there with hoarded wealth. From Samuel to Jesus to today, our calling is the same. Our calling is the calling to stand up for a world in which the resources of this planet are shared so that everyone knows a decent life. It's our job to maintain this truth as it's been maintained and handed down from generation to generation, and then plant this truth into the lives of the greater community so that it might flourish as a hopeful alternative to the direction the world is now headed. This is our gift, a gift we receive from God, a gift we share with the world, and it's good news.